All right. Well, hopefully you're having fun in the plug fest so far. I'm going to talk about objects and properties and how to manipulate them and read them. It's pretty basic stuff. Hopefully I will not bore you too much. My name is Juan Pablo Moreira. I'm a principal dev lead in the exchange team. All right, let's get started. So, I had a lot of trouble coming up with this slide. What I wanted to say was a very simple concept. It was that, okay, well, the data in Exchange is ordered or stored in a group of objects that are made up of properties. And then, of course, I find myself trying to define what an object was, which is, of course, impossible in software because it's such an overloaded term. So I decided to cheat. I'm going to cheat for this presentation and say, well, I'm going to make my own definition of object for this discussion. And what we're going to understand as object is an entity that's made out of properties, and we're going to narrow it down to these four type of objects that you find in Exchange. It's a message, a folder, an attachment, and a store object. The store object represents the mailbox itself, the public store. I don't want to confuse this with server objects, which are the handles we use to manipulate these guys in the protocol. For example, you probably heard Joe talk about download context and stuff like that. Those are not objects for the terms of this discussion, but there are server objects that you use to manipulate things in the exchange. Property is a little simpler. It's just a key value pair. We all know what a property is. It exists in many other protocols. Properties really define what an object is. It's not only the characteristics around the object, but it includes what identifies an object, entry IDs, folder IDs, that kind of stuff. So this is the basic pattern for modifying an object. And this should, for those of you who have been using the protocol for a while, this might seem pretty basic. This pattern will occur throughout when you try to modify objects. It's pretty much open, get yourself a handle to the object you want to modify, set properties, modify contain objects, then save or persist, and release. I'm using these terms very loosely. There are different ROPs that apply to these depending on the different type of objects, and I'll go over that. Then I got to my second slide, and I said, oh, well, I need to define contain objects, and here I am with the same problem. I have to cheat again and say, well, contain objects for the terms of this discussion is attachments that are contained in messages and embedded messages that are contained in attachments. That's what I refer to contain objects in here. There are also streams, but streams are not really objects. Streams are another way of seeing a property. But this pattern for modification applies to stream too. So I'm going to include it here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about using streams. All right. Modifying an object. So let's go a little bit over the rules of what this means. Well, open create, let's say like open message or create message, this is how you get your handle of the thing you're going to modify. Set properties. Here, there are several ROPs that allow you to change some properties in the objects, typically set properties or either manipulate streams in it. It's important to note that when you do set properties, the changes are not persisted until you call save. Modify your contained objects. And here is, this is sort of a recursive form. So here you will see ROPs to, again, open a contained object and set properties on it and save it. Finally, save, which is the one that says, okay, well, all the changes you did to an object, now it's time to persist them. And I'm using the word persist very loosely here. And what I mean, and this is probably something that Daryl discussed in his talk on Tuesday, what I mean by persist is when I say that something is persisted, I am manipulating an object through this handle, through this server object, and I won't see the changes on this other handle, either on the same client or a different client until I persist it. That's all that it means. I will see the changes on the same handle that I'm using, but I won't see it somewhere else until the save comes. And then release. Release, I put it here because just to clarify, well, you call release, you can no longer manipulate the object, you don't have access to it. All right, and whoa, colors. I like colors. Here I'm just trying to exemplify what are the ROPs that I would use to modify, in this case, create a message with an attachment and with a stream in that attachment. Send email is interesting because then we have submit, and submit acts in a similar way to save. It also does that persisting. So yes, you could replace submit here. It's a little. It acts like a save. It does the persisting in addition to submitting for the email and sending it over. So this is rather basic. The only thing I want to clarify here is, well, you need, for example, in the attachment to, for your properties that you change in your attachment, you need to call save changes attachment. That is not enough. That is required to save changes in the attachment, but they will not be actually persisted and seen on other objects until you save your container object, in this case, a message. Well, let's imagine you create a message, and this message, you want to create a message with an attachment, for example, an image or something like that. So you create your message. You set some properties, my subject, whatever it is. You create an attachment, set some properties like the name of your file or whatever the attachment represents. You open your stream, and then you start streaming the data of your image. The stream is just a property. In the case of the attachment, we're usually talking of attached data bin. I forget the names of properties, but I'm sure you'll find them in the glossary. That's the main data stream property in the attachment. You write the file, say an image, with several write streams. Usually, it will take several, depending on the size of the image or depending on the size of the data that you want to send, it will take several write streams to go through it. At the end, you commit it, meaning okay, all these things you committed to the store, but that does not get committed until you call save attachments, and even that is not get committed until the container object gets saved. So you could potentially abandon your changes, say you already wrote all these things to your object that you're manipulating, but you never called save changes message, the changes get abandoned. Or if you fail to call save changes message for whatever reason, let's say you have a network error, those changes don't actually get persisted and never get seen by other people accessing the same object.
Does that cause resource leaks?
I don't think that would cause repeat the question. So the question is, would that cause resource leaks on exchange? So let's picture this. So you have a connection, and you open an object. Let's say not even setting properties or anything. You just open an object, got a handle to it. There is something in the server that is representing the object that you're manipulating. Now, your connection breaks. Well, that will trigger a rundown of the connection on the server side. If that didn't trigger a rundown of the connection on the server side, then we would imagine, well, that object that existed in exchange would be leaked. But that triggers a rundown of the connection, and that means, well, all the objects associated with this connection need to be released. So, no, it will not create leaks in the exchange server. Theoretically, it would, but because we associate all the objects that were open with the connection, with that connection, and when we run down, we dispose of them or release them, then no, it won't cause a leak. Does that make sense?
So if the connection remains open, then potentially all of this stuff just gets built on the connection until...
You can keep opening objects until you hit a limit of, oh, you cannot open objects anymore because you're using too many resources. Yes. Yes. So if a client decides to just keep opening stuff and forgets to release them, eventually he run into a limit.
I think on that concept, Russ, the concept that you talk about the connection, we have a presentation, multiple PCP, RPC,
Well, and I might need, yeah.
We kind of clarified in the previous practice, basically, from exchange perspective, it's not aware of the DCRPC runtime, just know that the DCRPC runtime server gave him a connection, which could be association.
Yes, yes. Yes, absolutely. All right, here I just wanted to point a couple of interesting stuff regarding the pattern. So it's okay to say more than once. Obviously, the changes that you have done before the save are the ones that get applied when that save happens. It is okay to have changes after you did the save. They will just be abandoned if you don't persist them. And you might think, well, this is strange. Why would you want to do that? We have seen clients do this kind of stuff, where they would make changes to an object and then use ROPs like copyTo to transfer these changes to another object and then maybe persist that and abandon the one that they were using. It's valid. It's a little odd of a pattern, but it's valid to do. All right, so as any good rule, we have exceptions to this. I would say there are little unfortunate exceptions, but we definitely have exceptions. First off, the folder objects and the store objects don't have a save form. Like the message have save changes message and save changes attachment. This means that the set props get applied immediately to the folder objects and to the store objects. Streams, I want to call out streams a little bit because they're a bit confusing. First off, I have to repeat, they're not really objects. They are a representation of a property in an object. However, most of the pattern applies to stream, except for this little caveat, which is you don't actually have to call commit stream to commit it. It would be nice if we require it, but we don't. The client, unfortunately, does not always send rob commit stream, and we don't enforce it on the server. That means that there's the rules that we follow is, well, the server must not require the client to set the commit stream, which puts the server in an interesting situation that where you have to consider a write as a commit at the end. And in general, we recommend the client to be more robust and set commit stream at the end. Reading objects. This is way easier. So if you already looked at how we write objects, then reading objects is just a reduced form of the same pattern. We just open an object to get a handle to it. We can read properties. We can read their contained objects, and then we release. Same pattern as before, except without the saving. It's important to note that you can read objects. Well, you can read properties of objects that you are modifying. You can just interleave them. You can you can create a message, set some properties, and read them back, and then send some other properties. There's no enforcement. I'm only going to write to this object, and I cannot read properties back. No. You can read from an object that you're modifying. And this is the same, but a simplified form for reading. Same concept, except reading instead of writing. So, okay, so that pattern applies to most objects, so how do I get a hold of an object? Here I'm going to go through the different type of objects that I talked about and how do you identify them and get a hold of them. So store object, you get a hold of your store object by doing a logon. You identify your store object that you want to get by the mailbox you're opening, and or in the case of public folders, it's your default public folder. Public folder store associated with your mailbox. The folder, you use create folder or open folder, and you identify your folder from a fit, by a fit, a folder ID. The message, you either do create message or open message, and you identify it through a folder ID plus a message ID. It's important to note, well, embedded messages don't really have an ID of themselves. They're identified by the attachment that contains that message. Attachments have an attachment ID, a attachment number, and that is only unique within the context of that message. So you cannot identify an attachment anywhere in the store. It's just an attachment within that message that you can identify. And you get it through create attachment or open attachment. And then you have streams. And I keep repeating, stream is not really an object. It's just a property, but we treat it in a similar fashion. And you get it through rope open stream. And of course, the way you identify a stream is by the property tag itself, like you would identify another property using get props or something like that, get properties. OK, so now those are the objects that I'm manipulating. And I'm manipulating by changing their properties. So how do I look at the properties themselves? The properties throughout the protocol are identified by a property tag. The property tag is simply a 32-bit value. And it contains some type information. It contains an ID. And it is made of two parts, the type and the ID. There is another concept in there you probably have seen in the documentation, which is the name properties. The name properties are not a replacement of property tags. They're just a way to extend the schema. So that's a way to allow clients or servers to extend the schema and say, well, we're going to add some other information to an object, some other information that maybe not all the clients or not all the servers know about. In this way, I can say, well, these are the new properties or new information that I want to attach to an object. Name properties are made of two parts. The first part is your namespace GUID, and that is a GUID that is going to identify this group of properties that I have defined. Now, within that namespace, I identify unique properties with an ID. There's two ways of doing that. There's an integer type of ID and a string type of ID. They're basically the same thing. It's just an identifier within that namespace. They are under the control, let's say, of the entity that is responsible of that namespace. For example, if I'm a new client and I'm talking about new types of properties and I declare a GUID saying this is the GUID, my namespace, my sort of private properties I am going to talk about. Well, I'm the one responsible for giving a unique ID within that namespace to each one of my properties. Now, how does the server figure out all this stuff? Well, we need to be able to map these new name properties that the client defines or that another entity defines to property tags. And this mapping occurs on the server and triggered by the client when the client issues get IDs from names, rob get IDs from names. And that's a way of the client saying, this is a name property and potentially a new name property that you do not know about. What is the associated property tag for that? If the server doesn't know about this name property, it will create a new association and keep it in the database or whatever it stores it. And it will know about this association from then on. It will be able to return it back to the client by the client issue get names from IDs. It's important to know that these associations are per mailbox. The mapping between property tag
per mailbox.
Per store. My bad. I sometimes confuse mailbox and store. In this case, it could be a public folder store, for example. Well, yes, and that is considered actually conceptually a different mailbox. Therefore, the mappings are not necessarily the same. Sometimes we get a question about why is this particular property or that particular property not documented or whatever? Why is it not part of the official documentation? And in the case of name properties, it's very simple. Even in the case of property tax, and I explained that. With this mechanism, a client or a server can talk about a property that they only know about. It's an opaque property that they associate with an object, and they're not trying to collaborate with anybody else about how this property is used. So those properties, you won't find them in documentation. There's no need to do any any work with them. There's no collaboration between the client and the server with these properties. But the properties that where there needs to be collaboration, where they need to be understood by the two parties, or more than one party, then they need to be documented. So manipulating properties. I'm going to go through this very quickly. These are the ROPs that we use to manipulate properties. Set properties is pretty much the only one, aside from streams, to modify the values on an object. And then we have ways to getting values on an object. Get property specific gets you particular property tags. Get properties all tries to get you all the properties that are in the object. Get property list tries to tell you what are the properties that are available in the object without giving you the values. It's important to note, well, there might be too much information coming back when you're asking for these properties. What happens when when a particular property is too large? In that case, the property will return us an error saying not enough memory, and you can use streams to get the value of these properties. In the case where you were to ask for properties that are not streamable, meaning I will go to there, properties that are not variable length or they're not streamable, and you request this with a very small return buffer, or a client requests this with a very small return buffer, and there would be no way of fitting even the atomic properties in the buffer, then you get something like a buffer too small, asking you, okay, well, this is not enough to give you the information you want, even if we were to exclude the variable length properties. And that leads us to streams. Well, what happens when you want to manipulate one of those properties that can be potentially too large, say an image or something like that, or a body of a really long message? So streams are not particular to this protocol. They're used in software and in many other places. It's just a way to being able to manipulate large bodies of data. I'm simply going to give you these pieces of data in chunks. Here's the first part, here's the next part, and so on. There are only four types of properties that are supported in the protocol as that can be transferred as streams. And they are the ones listed there, binary and object, which is really binary, and the two forms of string, the string 8 and the Unicode string, the string type. It's important to know that streams do not support multi-value properties, even of these types. No form of multi-value properties are supported as streams. And these are the ROPs to manipulate streams. They're rather obvious in what they do. You open your stream, and then you read or write to it. You can seek around. You can truncate it or reduce its size by calling set size. And in the end, you should call commit stream. And write commit stream is just a shortcut for both write and commit. Whoa, I'm running out of time. No, I'm not. I have another half hour. Okay, so here's just an example of trying to put this together. Here I'm going to try to create a message with an embedded message, and then I'm going to try to read it back. It should be pretty straightforward. Those are the properties. Those are the ROPs I'm going to use. And this is how it looks. All right, so I create my message. Here I have my server object handle. Talking about my input handle is which folder am I going to create it on. And this is which handle I'm going to use to manipulate the message when it comes back, the output handle. I don't want it to be an associated message, and this is the idea of the folder where I'm going to be creating that message. Okay, then we have, your set properties. I'm going to just set, the subject. I'm going to set a subject that I can help me identify this is the correct message. I'm just going to say this is the subject of my outer message that I'm talking about here. And I'm going to operate on the message that I just created that was returned from my previous create message. So my output, success. Of course, we like successes and no property problems. Then I'm going to create an attachment within that. I'm operating on the message again, and it's going to return me a handle. My handle that I'm going to use for this attachment is number 4. I get an attachment ID. Again, this ID helps me identify the attachment within that message. Okay, so I create an attachment. Within that attachment, I'm going to create an embedded message. There's only one ROP to get a handle of an embedded message, and that is open embedded message. It is used both for creation and opening an existing embedded message. So here I'm operating on my attachment. I'm going to get my embedded message. And as the output of open embedded message, I get all this information about the embedded message. Of course, I just created the message, so it's not going to have anything, right? But this is the standard output for open embedded message, which is used for both creating and opening. So you see default values in there, which are pretty much empty. We don't have anything in that message yet. Then I'm going to set properties on that embedded message. Here I'm going to try to identify this as, oh, this is my embedded message, not the outer one. Okay, now I save changes to my embedded message. This is now persisted, but not really, because the outer objects are not yet saved. I can release it now. Not going to use it anymore. I don't have access to it anymore. I save my attachment again. Now, these would not take effect until this happens, but this still does not take effect because there's still an outer object that has not been saved. If any of those steps were to be excluded, then those changes will not take effect. I can release my attachment now. Not going to use it. And I finally save the outer message. It's important now I get here my message ID. Now this is the way that I will be able to identify the message I just created. If I go back to this save changes message, notice that this ID that I get back is 0. This message, this embedded message, does not really have an ID that you can use to open the message. The message is identified by the attachment that contains it. And then I release my outer message. That's great. So now I want to verify that everything worked. And I'm going to use the other pattern. Open and read from the object. So now I open my message. Here is I use my ID here of the message, and I open it on the same folder. I'm going to get my message in that handle number 6. Here, the output of open message gives me some preview of what the message has. This is a standard output of open message, and I can see here that it is the subject of my outer message, which is what I expect. Then I'm going to get properties on it. I'm going to retrieve the subject again just because I'm stubborn. I know it's the correct subject. I got it from OpenMessage, but here I am trying to get the subject again. And yes, it is my outer message, no problem. Then we can go and try to open the attachment. I know that it is attachment 0. That's what when I created the first time, it had the ID of 0. And now I can try opening the attachment that returns success with no extra preview stuff. Then I use open message attachment. I want to get open embedded message. I want to get to the internal message. It is the same ROP that I used to create it, but in this case, I'm not going to pass the create flag. I'm going to say, give me the embedded message that exists there already. In here, now I get some information. Before, I was just getting empty because it was just being created. Now I get the normal preview information, if you want to call it. And it is correct. It is the subject of the embedded message. Again, I'm being stubborn. I'm going to call get properties, make sure that everything's fine. I call get properties, access again the subject, yes, it is indeed your embedded message. Stop asking me. It is the right one. And then I release everything. And that is all I have. Yes?
With the IC
CSM fast transfer, you don't need most of those
well, objects. That is correct. So there's two ways. There's two ways pretty much to manipulate objects. One is through this, what we in-house call them the online ROPs. It's not an official term, where you go through this pattern. And the other way is what Joe talked about on Tuesday, which is the fast transfer, which where you can push the whole information of a message in one go or pull it. And in that case, of course, you need to be able to parse through that stream that you're getting back. Yes.
I start over?
Please start.
Okay. So within the create message reply, we do have this has message ID boolean value that lets you specify whether or not the server will return a valid mid or not, or just zero for the message you just created.
Let's see. So which create message are we talking about?
Yeah, for the create message and the server reply. Yep.
Where are you? Has valid message ID?
Well, in the documentation, you have the has message ID and message ID optional.
Has message ID and message ID optional. Maybe I can see it.
Yep. I may find it again. It's not Rob Save Messages. It's right here.
Has message ID.
No, so we have it.
Please validly specify whether the message ID field is present. Body sentence, face sentence, present if zero. Okay, let's see.
So, merely the question is if a create message is supposed to be. Virtual until we do the save change messages, and if we allocate a mid, this mid will get consumed. So if we are just doing create messages and ask for a message ID and we get one, at some point we will run out of mid, and we'll basically crash the mailbox.
Okay, one
very thing. Very theoretically. I mean, I know we are talking about a 64-bit integer for.
If you're saying if somebody just keeps creating messages,
yeah, and
just keeps calling create messages,
yeah, and we retrieve a mid associated to this virtual message that we want to create.
I'm a little confused because the ID of the message is not assigned until you call saved. I'm not sure. I will have to go back and double check.
So probably a bug in the or historical reason. Maybe.
No, I don't think so. It's most likely that it always returns false. I will go back and check what does it mean, has message ID. But because when you create a message, it is not the time where the ID is set. It is when you call save.
Okay.
I need to get back to you on on when is this field ever true of has message ID. Your other question is, if you keep opening messages by creating message, is that the question? So the question is, what happens if I just start out create? Mm-hmm. Are we gonna, run out of IDs or run out of memory, or are you gonna hit some sort of limit? It is the same limit that you hit if you try to just open. Eventually, you will have too many opened objects, and there, I think too many objects open is the error that you get back.
Okay.
Another question, and it's really about whether recipients is almost like an embedded object, and is that how you kind of conceptually think about it?
I mean,
it's a little bit different, but
okay. So the question is: are recipients also considered like contained objects? Well, at that point, is how do you see it? How do you conceptualize it? you could see it as, well, is the recipient table a contain object? Or is it just a property? It's hard to say. I did not put recipients in here, and I did not group them together with the other contain objects because the pattern is a little different. When you want to change recipients, you don't have this open recipients set property save. You have modify recipients, which is slightly different. So how would the pattern vary here? It is similar. You just open your message, and you call modify recipients. This is similar to a call you would do to change properties on a message. So it's a little more similar to changing properties than to changing a contain object. So you say modify recipients, and you immediately operate on the message. You don't operate on the recipient table to modify it. However, to read it, you operate on the table, which is a little tricky. So you open your message, and you get your recipient table, and then you operate on the table as you're operating with other tables, like your attachment table or your hierarchy or your contents table. So I wouldn't, for the sake of how do you manipulate recipients, I personally would not group it with other contain objects because it behaves differently. Does that answer the question? Nothing else? Okay. Well, thank you very much.